This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, single-payer health care is gaining support on Capitol Hill, with a majority of House Democrats now in favor of Medicare for All. The Black Is Back Coalition puts the political emphasis on self-determination, and we'll have a discussion with Danny Haifong on what's wrong with the left in the U.S.
But first, last Monday was a very important date in the life of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner. Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with Dr. Johanna Fernandez, a professor of history and African American studies at New York's Baruch College and founder of the campaign to bring Mumia home.
Mumia had a hearing in the Court of Common Pleas in Pennsylvania, a very important hearing in which he presented his case to that court, and he used the case of Williams versus Pennsylvania, a very important case that was decided last summer. This is the first case in the history of the United States that addresses the issue of judicial bias and the lack of due process as a result of judicial bias. In this case, Williams versus Pennsylvania, the defendant argued that the judge was impartial and did not grant him relief on the issues presented in his appeal because the judge had previously been a prosecutor at the time that the prisoner was being convicted. Many years later, the judge, formerly a prosecutor, denies the defendant a fair hearing on his appeals, and the Supreme Court, in fact, said yes. If a prosecutor was at all personally involved or interested in a conviction, later when he becomes a judge, he's not going to review the case for an appeal of this prisoner fairly. What's important for your audience to know is that the same judge involved in the Williams versus Pennsylvania case, Judge Ronald Castile, was the same judge who in the 1980s and in the 1990s ruled on Mumia's appeals and denied him a fair hearing in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. What's important to underline also is that this is a case, Williams versus Pennsylvania, that is not just of interest to Mumia. It's of interest to hundreds, if not thousands, of Pennsylvania prisoners who are also presenting the same issue in the courts right now. On the same day that Mumia was presenting his case to the Court of Common Pleas, 16 other Pennsylvania prisoners were doing the same on the same issue. In the case of Judge Ronald Castile, who was the head of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court at the time that Mumia presented his arguments for appeal, Mumia's attorneys asked the judge to recuse himself because he had previously received funding from the Fraternal Order of Police and, in fact, was identified by the Fraternal Order of Police as their Man of the Year. The judge refused to recuse himself in the case of Mumia's appeals, arguing that he would not recuse himself because there were seven other judges in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court who had also received funding from the Fraternal Order of Police. Now, as your listeners know, the Fraternal Order of Police was at the time and still is today the major organization lobbying for Mumia's conviction and for his execution. So this is clearly a case in which a judge is materially invested in denying Mumia any kind of relief from the courts. And we're talking about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the most famous prisoner in this nation and in the world. If Mumia is granted relief, and if his case gets into the courts again, and if we win Mumia's freedom, this would be a game changer. It would really expose the rotten, corrupt nature of the criminal justice system. It would give confidence to the movement to end the gulag that is mass incarceration. And it would strengthen our movements in the struggle to transform society fundamentally. So I'm excited. I think the movement to bring Mumia home is excited. And we understand that the work before us now is to raise the profile of Mumia's case once again, tie it to all of the problems with mass incarceration and to the many problems of late 21st century capitalism. So we are asking people to really join us in this struggle.
How can we make sense of Mumia's case in this present era in 2017 after all of these years and years of clashes around this law and order narrative? Could you help us to kind of situate Mumia's case within this broader framework?
Well, I think it's important for us to remember that the project of mass incarceration was essentially a backlash to the civil rights and Black Power movements of the 1960s and early 1970s. It is quite ironic that precisely at the moment when African Americans gain the right to vote, the United States begins to mass imprison African Americans, and in so doing, essentially disenfranchise huge sections of that community. Incarceration, as it grew exponentially for the first time in American history after 1973 and in the 1980s, was a means of reestablishing social control in American society in the aftermath of the 60s movements, which dealt a pretty huge blow to American hegemony. But it was also a way of punishing the descendants of slaves for daring to assert their rights in American society as courageously and forcefully and valiantly as they did in the 1960s. Now, the history of the Black Panther Party is critical in this narrative, because part of what the Black Panther Party did was that it neutralized the power of the police. It exposed its corruption, and in fact, it popularized the notion that the police were, in the language of the period, pigs. So what we see in the aftermath of the Black Power movement is the idea that killing a police officer is the biggest crime in American society. And killing a white police officer becomes synonymous in the post-civil rights movement era, especially in the North, with the myth of Black men raping white women. And this becomes the narrative that helps to strengthen the project of mass incarceration. And it targets radicals like the Black Panthers, who essentially were exposing police brutality, police homicidal brutality in Black communities, and police corruption. And so if you look around at all of the political prisoners who are in prison today in American society, they're all framed for killing a white police officer. And Mumia Abu-Jamal, of course, is at the center of this narrative. Mumia Abu-Jamal is demonized as a Black radical, a Black Panther. He's on the left. Everything that both conservatives and Democrats want to undo in the post-civil rights and Black movement era is represented in the figure of Mumia. he's demonized for being a celebrity by the establishment and by the police. And he's demonized for speaking out and for doing what he's been doing from death row and from general population for the last 30 some odd years. But the question is, what role does the narrative of crime play in our society? And I think we have to take a step back and say that crime and incarceration and anti-immigrant sentiment, these have been the major public policy issues that have been debated in American society over the last 40 years. And they've been used by politicians to distract Americans from the real source of discontent in American society. And what is the real source of discontent in American society, which the narrative of crime blinds most Americans to, because we are too busy fearing and demonizing Black people, immigrants, and Muslims to know better? The real problem is that there has been a class war that's been deployed by the captains of capitalism in the last 40 years, and they've deployed this class war to maximize profits at a moment when U.S. capitalism has had enormous amount of competition from Germany, China, Japan. That means that in the global market, American capitalism is not top dog as it was in the 1950s. So it has had to maximize profits, increase its profits by hook or crook. And how has it done that? It's done that through an attack on working class gains. How? You probably know that there has been a radical decrease in working class wages in the last 40 years. And this has pretty much meant the end of the American dream. There's been also an elimination of decent and affordable health care. In the 1970s, most Americans got health care through their employers, but their employers have now eliminated health care as a benefit. And this was, of course, won through the labor struggles of the 1930s. There's also been an elimination completely of the nation's historically feeble safety net, welfare. And that's happened through the demonization of Black women in particular and immigrants who are depicted in the media as people who are sucking off the teat of the system and taking advantage of welfare, when in fact, the majority of people on welfare are poor white people. And compared to the corruption on Wall Street and in corporations, the corruption in welfare is insignificant. What else has this class war looked like? There have been serious cuts to public spending, generally speaking, in education and health. And in its totality, this is an assault on the working class that has led to the misery of the working and middle class of this country, of all colors. But the attention and the scapegoating of Black people as criminals and immigrants and Muslims has distracted Americans from this reality. And so part of what we are arguing and part of what we are doing in the campaign to bring Mumia home is challenging the narrative of crime as it has been consolidated and articulated in Mumia's case and in the cases of others, because if we do not address the ways in which racism, the new racism of the post-civil rights and Black Power movement era with the code word crime, if we do not address racism and its manifestations in American society, we are not going to be able to come together to launch a fight back against the people at the top of the society who are running, laughing all the way to the bank at our expense.
You visited with Brother Mumia recently. If you wanted to share anything from that meeting, you know, how is he doing? How is he reading what's going on in the courts right now with respect to his case? If there's anything from that visit that you would like to share, that would be great. And if there's anything on the horizon for the campaign to bring Mumia home that people should be aware of, please share that as well.
Yes. So I visited Mumia just this last Friday, April 28th. And Mumia is in good spirits. He began treatment for hepatitis C medication, the cure, on April 6th, and that is going to be a 12-week treatment. As you probably know, it took 2 years to get him treated and a long battle in the streets and in the courtroom. We sued the Department of Corrections and won. So this is a real people's victory. Not long ago, I think last Thursday, the 27th, Mumia was transferred to the infirmary at the prison late at night and not told why he was being transferred. And then in the morning, he was taken 3 hours away to a hospital to get some tests done. And because they didn't inform him of what was happening, he thought that he was being transferred to a different facility. But essentially, a people's movement has forced the DOC to treat him. And they are scared because we are in the process of suing them for damages. Unfortunately, over the 2 years that he was not treated, Mumia developed cirrhosis, which is a scarring of the liver. And although we believe that he will emerge cured of his hepatitis C, he is now vulnerable to liver cancer because he has cirrhosis, and he's going to have to be monitored for the rest of his life. So given the situation that we're in with this Williams versus Pennsylvania case, the significance of this case, not just for Mumia and opening up his conviction in the courts, but also in terms of what it means for prisoners in Pennsylvania and across the country, the campaign to bring Mumia home wants to launch a propaganda campaign to raise the significance of this case. And so we're asking people to join us. We need artists, we need people who have video making skills, and we're asking them to contact us if they want to help us do a small video around this issue. And our email address that you can contact us through is bringmumiahome@gmail.com. Once again, bringmumiahome@gmail.com. We understand that in order to gain justice in this country and anywhere around the world, as Frederick Douglass instructed us over 100 years ago, without struggle, there is no progress. We need to hit the streets, and we need to take back the narrative.
That was Dr. Johanna Fernandez of the campaign to bring Mumia home, speaking from New York.
Danny Haifong is an activist and social worker in Boston and a weekly contributor to Black Agenda Report. In a recent article, Haifong explored the state of radical politics in this country. The piece was titled, "The Left's State of Purgatory." We asked Haifong if what passes for the left in the United States would even be recognizable to leftists in most of the world.
Definitely not. I talk a lot about in my article the state of purgatory that I think this whole concept of the left really is in the United States. We have a situation where the Trump administration has basically been so bent over a barrel by the deep state that it risks a nuclear conflagration in relation to the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, as well as its hostilities towards Syria, which, of course, always connects back to the bigger question of the role of Russia and the U.S. in their growing conflicts that Trump inherited. So we're in a situation where all of this is happening, but there's little resistance to any of it. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that it became fashionable to support imperialism, and it became almost a leftish fetish to basically support the war efforts of the Democratic Party. And in many ways, this has been both very overt and omnipresent in the fact that a lot of the Democratic Party, if not the entire Democratic Party electorate, has been driven to the right of the Republicans on a lot of questions. Even the Sanders folks who supported Bernie Sanders so much didn't really challenge his foreign policy, which didn't really break from the Democratic Party establishment one bit. And then you have the Hillary Clinton supporters who are rabidly pro-war, and we would have probably found ourselves in a similar situation that we are in right now with the Trump presidency. So what we are left with is a bunch of organizations who claim independence, organizations, formations, splinter groups, and whatnot who claim independence from the Democratic Party, but who repeat the same ideological position that the State Department holds around the question of North Korea and Syria, Russia, China, calling them all dictatorships and regimes, and basically falling into the whole dehumanizing and racist rhetoric that helps justify war against the peoples of those regions in the first place. So this is where we're at. And I think that it is so telling that in this period where we have both the GOP-led Senate and Congress, as well as a presidency, that there's little to no anti-war and anti-imperialist activity to be seen. So this really poses the question of what is the left and how do we build a real left formation or an organization that can challenge these maladies?
In your article, you name several publications, the editors of which would certainly bridle if you called them anything but credentialed leftists.
Exactly. I mean, unfortunately, some of these left journals, academics, as well as media outlets like Democracy Now!, The Intercept, although they do have some use on some questions in terms of domestic U.S. politics and whatnot, whenever the question of international politics is brought up, usually they fall right in line with the imperialist narrative, or they try to straddle the line, as I say, between opposing war that the U.S. wages, but at the same time opposing the very targets of those wars, which really only helps U.S. imperialism achieve its objectives by confusing people. I mean, what else could be more confusing than, well, U.S. imperialism is bad, but so too are the governments that U.S. imperialism wants to destroy. It's really hard to take any sort of concrete position in that way. And so what this does is it reinforces this white supremacist and imperialist ideology, which thrive under the conditions of decay that you talk a lot about, Book Like a Gender Report talks a lot about, under this U.S. imperialist system, where not only has the U.S.'s economic influence in the world dwindled, but also its position as just a hegemonic power in the world is starting to decline. And that is also reflected in the deteriorating conditions for working class and oppressed people here, especially Black people. So these conditions are really indicative of a crisis that cannot be reconciled anymore. And really, the justification for these conditions are holding on by a threadbare narrative that is only aided by these left groups and organizations that repeat the imperialist mantras.
Yes, you seem to be saying that in looking at this American left, which is largely not left, we're talking about a problem that is much deeper than the Democratic Party's drift to the right or the successful selling of humanitarian military intervention, but an imperial, and as you said, white supremacist ideology in the United States that infects directly the left. And that's not new.
No, it's not new. But it has definitely, due to the fact that the conditions in the world, the imperialist system, have become so acute, the crisis of the system has become so acute, this ideology has been able to thrive. And a lot of people see this thriving of white supremacy and racism as being reflected in the Trump phenomenon. But I don't think that it can be really restricted to the so-called rise of the far right when we have a condition where the left is basically supporting U.S. imperialist war abroad and had an opportunity through the campaigns of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump to formulate a real program that could appeal both to those who were drawn to, let's say, Trump's anti-regime change rhetoric and Bernie Sanders's economic populist program for free public higher education, as well as higher wages and that sort of thing. There was a real opportunity to do that, but because the left was so concerned about talking about this rise of the far right without actually questioning and reflecting on its own imperialist sentiments when it comes to questions of war, we find ourselves in a position where we don't have a mass movement that can relate the deteriorating conditions in the United States to the warfare that its government wages abroad.
Imperial war makers invest heavily in dehumanization, which in a racist country is something that's quite easy to do. It's almost second nature. And certainly Syria and North Korea have been thoroughly dehumanized in the American eye.
Right. The Syrian people and the people of the Korean Peninsula are all seen as unable to govern themselves and are unable to live and determine their own destinies due to the fact that they are under the grip of these murderous and crazed dictators, which has been attractive to a lot of people in the United States. It's been an attractive narrative because ultimately in the United States, its very roots are infected with this notion that Black people and all peoples who fall outside of the flexible spectrum of whiteness at any given historical moment could be considered both expendable and or in need of super exploitation because they themselves do not have the capabilities as human beings to govern themselves and to determine their own destiny. So the ideology of white supremacy definitely relates on all fronts. And I think what really buttresses and allows this ideology to infect even the most well-meaning leftist organizations, groups, scholars, and what have you, is the fact that we still have not been able to come to terms with the changes of the U.S. imperialist system over the last 3 or 4 decades, the crisis of the system, and how new political developments under the changing and decaying imperialist system, such as the Black misleadership class, this new mass Black incarceration state over the last 3 or 4 decades, this new advanced technological capitalist system, which has advanced technological revolution, which has under capitalism replaced much of the labor force and has made much of it expendable, especially the Black worker. All of these changes have had a conservatizing effect when in the end, they are dictated by the finance capital and monopoly capitalist class and discourse that they've been able to promote to justify all of these changes.
Given the backwardness and sometimes outright fraudulence of much of what calls itself the left, how does one respond to calls for left unity in the face of Trump and other reactionary threats?
Well, I think it's complicated, but what has really made this question of left unity so difficult is the fact that it was never really based on principles in the first place. And what I mean by that is not that rejecting white supremacy or rejecting racist and sexist rhetoric, tone, and behavior on the part of Donald Trump himself was in fact not principled, but that what was really being missed was the entire moment that the election season and now the Trump era really signaled, which was an obvious decline and crisis in the entire apparatus and the entire state apparatus of U.S. imperialism, and the fact that there are millions of people right now who were attracted to certain positions that could really comprise of a real working class program that we desperately need right now, and an organization that we desperately need to take some of these positions, like Trump's anti-regime change rhetoric during his campaign, like Bernie Sanders's call for higher wages and healthcare and education, out of the electoral machine and into the mass movement and into the mass discourse, because that's what's really missing right now. And now that we see that deep state and the Washington apparatus has tamed Trump to an extent where he basically looks like a more brash Hillary Clinton, we're not any way better for this so-called call for left unity against Trump when, in fact, the entire state apparatus is doing what it's wanted to do all along, which is wage more war, build the conditions for a third world war, and ultimately do what is best for the financiers, the bankers, and the monopoly capitalists at the expense of everyone else.
Yes, there certainly is a lot of agitation, and one could say that there is such a thing as an anti-Trump movement, but it's largely not a socially transformative movement and certainly not a peace movement.
Definitely not a peace movement from the very beginning. Most of the anti-Trump demonstrators, even a lot of those on the radical left, failed to reconcile and to address the contradictions of Trump's campaign, and ultimately, instead of engaging with masses of people around the questions of war and peace, really just brushed off some of the things he said as things that he didn't mean anyway, and now they're in the I told you so mood now that he has completely reneged on all of his campaign promises in regards to foreign policy. But what we saw from the anti-Trump movement, which I don't think is as strong as it was during the beginning of his presidency and in his campaign, due to the fact that a lot of it was actually based on fears of his connections with Russia, and a lot of it, there was a lot of Democratic Party funding in it. And now that we see more social peace in regards to the Trump administration within the establishment, we've also seen a weakening of the anti-Trump forces on the ground. And it's quite a sight to see, honestly, because while sites like Democracy Now! And The Intercept talk about things like the far right is rising even more, they're completely ignoring these larger questions of war and peace and the fact that we are really facing a crisis of an entire system of rule, of entire social order that Donald Trump will ultimately obey as president of the United States. And that's what he's doing. And we have to see it in that lens rather than focus on his individual self, which is so easy to do when the corporate media never stops its coverage of him.
When I hear your critique of institutions like Democracy Now! And publications like Intercept, I'm reminded of a phrase that we used to use ages ago: if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem.
It's as simple as that, really, because what we have to understand, I think, as those who are committed to fighting for a new world and who are really interested in confronting this profound crisis of imperialism before us, is that we really have to reflect on what are the limitations, the ideological limitations, as well as the material limitations that we're operating under. Right now, we're operating under the largest national security state apparatus that people in the United States have ever felt. We're operating under one of the most disastrous and precarious situations for working people and poor people in this country. We're operating under political conditions where there is no social democratic, so-called quote-unquote progressive faction inside of the ruling elite anymore. That has been thrown out. We are living under wall-to-wall imperialist rule. And that these are conditions that we have to confront, but we can't do that if we are going to pontificate about the character of the Syrian government and whether the DPRK is some sort of crazy dictatorship where people follow Kim Jong-un's every move and do whatever he says. All of that is just a reinforcement of imperialism and white supremacy, and it doesn't really get into what we need to do, which is build solidarity, build a movement on an internationalist basis where we see people of the world who are struggling against imperialism as humans and able to determine their own destiny. And that framework can then give us the ability to actually do the research, the study, the investigation, and conduct struggle, which allows us to find the reality of the situation. Because what we'll find is that the governments of North Korea and Syria and most countries that the U.S. wants to get rid of are not exactly what the corporate media and the Washington consensus likes to make them out to be.
That was Danny Haifong, a weekly contributor to Black Agenda Report, speaking from Boston.
The Donald Trump administration has joined with the Democrats in blaming the Russians for every crime under the sun. The latest tall tale is that the Russians are providing weapons to the Taliban in Afghanistan. We spoke with Omali Yesha Taylor, chairman of the Black Is Back Coalition, which has opposed U.S. warmongering since its founding in 2009.
I think that much of what has been called U.S. foreign policy is in a state of kind of disarray, and that right now they are attempting to pull it together. They're trying to take the kind of unvarnished articulations and threats made by Donald Trump during his candidacy and trying to make it fit some foreign policy objectives that have always been held by the rulers of this country. And increasingly, it seems like it's working in that direction. Trump has been, as you know, full of bluster about Korea and Iran and the situation in the Middle East. He's been full of bluster, but he hasn't brought with him any real program except he's going to bomb the hell out of everybody. And now that he's in office, it seems that more and more establishment leaders and people who have been tied to the state apparatus of seizing more control and giving more direction to what Trump's presidency will do, even though I don't think that's fully fleshed out. In terms of Korea, the thing that Trump has done is to offer more public bluster. But the war games and things like that that the United States government has been engaged in, obviously attempting to provoke the People's Democratic Republic of Korea, these games have been going on for a long time. And people haven't heard about these games. The only thing they've heard has been the responses from the People's Democratic Republic of Korea's government. They've heard the responses coming from Korea about these war games, about these provocations. And so they play this game of seeing how irresponsible and erratic and crazy the Korean government is without having put any evidence of the provocation. Trump's role now has been to show how tough the United States is. So what he's doing is also showing the provocation that's coming from the United States directed toward Korea. That's the thing that makes a difference. But that's no difference in terms of the stance, the provocation than Obama, than Bush, or any other regime. One thing is interesting is that up until now, the U.S. government has refused to talk directly to Korea. It has moved from this arrogant stance that to talk directly to Korea is to elevate them in stature and to recognize them in a fashion that they don't deserve. And so now I'm hearing Trump saying that everything is on the table, that they're even open to talking with Korea. That's a new thing that's now in the game. That before wasn't something that they even considered doing. So that's interesting. But I don't think there's been fundamentally that kind of difference, except, of course, what is scary to some extent is the aggression that they're making in Syria that stands the risk of attacking Russian, killing Russians, and coming into a more direct kind of a conflict with Russia. That's problematic. And that could offer some real serious possible confrontations. But the other thing is, though, back to Korea, is that in many ways, the issue of Korea is really the issue of China. And I'm not sure China could tolerate the U.S. military attack on Korea. If you remember, it was the U.S. attack on Korea that brought China into what was called the Korean War and resulted in the existence of the two Koreas now. There wouldn't be two Koreas, just be one reactionary Korea under the tutelage of U.S. imperialism if China hadn't intervened into that situation. So I think at the time, China saw it in its own national interest to intervene in that war. What China and the U.S. are talking about today behind closed doors is hard to say. This is not Mao Zedong's China that we're looking at, but it is a China that's nationalistic, that is determined to push U.S. out of its dominant hegemonic role in Asia. So it seems problematic how far China would be able to go with helping the Trump regime in its actions against Korea.
And what most Americans don't know is that South Korea itself, its four major candidates for president, all oppose these escalations in tensions, oppose U.S. military threats against the North.
I think that's really important. And also, what many don't know is the strength of the sentiment in the two Koreas for reunification, at least among the people, the masses of the people. I mean, there's a strong sentiment about reunifying Korea. And most people in this country, in the United States, don't understand that this is an artificial characterization. They are not two different peoples. It's one Korea that has been divided and separated by imperialism, just like Vietnam was a North and South as a consequence of U.S. and French intervention. So I think that's important, that there is an inclination among the Korean people for reunification. and that it is something that the United States government would be opposed to as long as the People's Democratic Republic of Korea exists. And so they would do anything they could to undermine that regime. And for them, a fundamental question is how far they are willing to go to make that happen, or to try to make that happen.
In terms of U.S. domestic politics, the more Trump blusters and actually does bomb, the more the corporate media seems to like him and the Democrats seem to like him.
I mean, that's really incredible, because if you remember, during the two conventions, the Republican and the Democratic convention, it was the Democratic convention that brought out all the generals and talked all the war bluster. And then it was Republican convention under the leadership of Donald Trump that was talking about no longer getting involved in regime changes and defunding NATO and defunding all of the other war efforts that the United States would be pursuing. And he was on the outs. Trump was on the outs with the entire establishment, both who call themselves Republicans and Democrats. Of course, this is the bourgeoisie that runs these institutions, this shell game they play with the two so-called different parties, both of which represent capitalism. And capital had already made some kind of decisions about how the world should be run. And Trump seems to be going contrary to that. And that was a problem that both Democrats and Republican parties had with him. And now Trump is acting normal and showing a willingness to bomb and kill and do the same kinds of things that imperialism, American imperialism in particular, has been noted for since its founding.
So the more the United States sends waves of fear across the world, the better the corporate media and both political parties feel.
I think that's true. And what I find interesting about that is that I think all of them misread what the possibilities are in this world and what the situation is in this world. And at one time, Trump had a better feel for that than he appears to have right now. Because what they are banking on is the 37% to 40% of the people who think Trump is doing a good job. And the majority of the people in this country and around the world do not believe that. And while the corporate media are singing the praises of Trump now for his willingness to threaten war, to provoke Korea, to provoke Iran, to provoke all of these other forces in the world, masses of people around the world don't have that same feeling. And I think they're misplaying their hand. I think the bourgeoisie is misplaying its hand, and that this unraveling of the process that has maintained this social system and this status quo for such a long period of time, I think this unraveling is still going to provide a lot of surprises for all of them, including Trump. Trump simply caught a train, a wave in the sentiment of masses of people inside this country, like Bernie Sanders took advantage of this wave, but it's not over because they cannot satisfy the interests of these masses of people. And some people feel some sense of satisfaction, Trump supporters, because Trump is still apparently going against the status quo as far as how he has carrying out his presidency, but even that, I believe, is going to be something that peters out, because it's going to be a time when he's going to have to satisfy some of the interests that people really wanted to see satisfied, and there's going to be a time where people are going to be dissatisfied with the fact that he's going along with the same status quo that he talked about being opposed to up until his candidacy. He's got a free ride up to now, but I don't think that's going to be a long period of time.
Yes, you say the American rulers are misplaying their hand, but what other hand do they have to play except war?
But they don't have any other plans except war, the threat of war. That's what they're banking on. And of course, the other thing that they bank on is the lack of a powerful alternative politic organization that challenges the status quo. This is what gave them a free ride. This is what Trump took advantage of. This is what Bernie Sanders was able to take advantage of, because there was nothing in contention. There was nothing in legitimate contention with where it was they were trying to go. So even though they only had a minority of the people, a minority, certainly not a majority of the people who were with them, either Hillary or Trump, there was not a legitimate, something that was recognized as a legitimate alternative to what it was that they were offering. And so Trump seemed to have been the alternative to the status quo, and Sanders appeared to have been the alternative to the status quo, but that's simply a serious criticism of what is supposed to be any kind of revolutionary movement inside this country that a guy like Trump and a guy like Sanders could pass themselves off as alternatives to what the rulers in this country are doing.
And of course, there are more wars than just the ones abroad. We're talking about the war at home. The Black is Back Coalition's topmost priority has been Black community control of the police.
And Black community control of the police is something that's definitely our effort to target this war that's being made in the streets of this country. And of course, that's just one aspect of the war. The other thing that this coalition has done that embraces Black community control of the police is that it has offered up the national platform for self-determination, the national Black political agenda for self-determination. This has been a fundamental thing. And then it has taken that into the electoral arena. I've just heard that one candidate who has just qualified for a ballot place as mayor in Detroit has got enough petitions running on a platform of racial reconciliation and reparations and running on the 19-point platform that came from the Black is Back Coalition. And there are two candidates in St. Petersburg, Florida, running on that same platform. And then there's a conference that's being held in May in St. Louis where a number of political forces from throughout the country will be coming together and will be struggling with the question of advancing this platform that's come from the coalition. And this is an anti-war coalition. It's an anti-war against what's happening in our community. It tackles the question of the massive incarceration, this colonial terror that's being waged against our people, stuffing Africans in these prisons. It deals with the question of gentrification, which is some people characterize as ethnic cleansing, certainly population removal that's happening throughout this country. And that, of course, is an assault on any kind of potential for economic and political power by African people in this country. And it is talking about all of the contradictions that contribute to the relentless war that we experience as African people, as Black people in this country. So there is a movement that's afoot here that I think is extremely important in terms of helping to define what the narrative is going to be moving forward, despite what Trump is attempting to do and despite what the rulers of this country are attempting to do through the office of the presidency under Donald Trump's leadership.
That was Omali Yeshitela of the Black is Back Coalition speaking from St. Petersburg, Florida.
For the first time ever, a majority of Democratic members of the U.S. House of Representatives now support Medicare for All. Dr. Margaret Flowers, a Baltimore-based activist with Popular Resistance, says the fight for single-payer health care has passed another milestone.
It certainly is, and actually it is a testament to the work of activists because the Democrats told us early on that this year it was all going to be about resisting Trump and not putting anything positive forward. But John Conyers introduced H.R. 676, the expanded and approved Medicare for All Act, in January, as he always does each session. And the activists got to work and pushed on members of Congress. And so the highest number we've had in the past is 93, and right now we're at 104 and rising.
So now a distinct minority of Democrats have failed to get on board. What kind of efforts are being made to get them on the side of Medicare for All?
Well, we're continuing. You know, we at Popular Resistance have the campaign Health Over Profit for Everyone, and there are a lot of other groups that are active around the country and pushing on members of Congress, including Republicans, to endorse Medicare for All. This really is something that members of Congress should support because it's the conservative approach in terms of spending. It saves the most money, but it gives people the most benefits and the best health security. So we really see this as a issue that every member of Congress should support. And we know that neither political party that's in power right now, the Republicans nor the Democrats, have a Medicare for All on their platform. So really, this is going to be a battle that's waged by the grassroots activists to push whoever's in power to take this approach.
What role did recent legislative events, the Republican attempt to repeal Obamacare, play in solidifying support for Medicare for All?
Yes, it's interesting. The Affordable Care Act, which was passed by the Obama administration, is basically a market-based solution, and it's so far to the right that the Republicans' attempts to push it even further to the right backfired, because anything more that they do to push it in that direction is going to result in greater federal spending and, you know, millions or tens of millions of more people without health insurance. So that approach just proved that that direction is not a possible direction to go in, and that's why this is absolutely the time for us to be pushing for the actual solution, a national improved Medicare for all.
Yes, as some people have said, the Republicans already had their perfect Republican bill in Obamacare and couldn't improve upon it.
Well, that's right. I mean, it actually was first, you know, originated at the state level by then Governor Mitt Romney in Massachusetts, who was a Republican. It came out of the Heritage Foundation, so it already was a Republican plan or conservative plan, you know, market-based plan from that standpoint. And what's interesting is that, you know, public support for Medicare for All, it's been pretty solid. You know, more than 60% of people across the political spectrum have supported it. But we're seeing that support growing even more and growing even in, you know, lower income Republicans, those who make less than $75,000 a year. More of them are starting to support this approach. So we're really moving in a great direction, but we know that it's still going to be a huge battle because we're coming up against these major industries, the pharmaceutical industry, the private health insurers who are making record profits right now. That's who we're up against in this fight.
Now, Conyers' single-payer bill, H.R. 676, is titled the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act. What does it mean, expanded and improved? What's different?
So what's different is that, you know, it's like traditional Medicare where it's paid for through taxes and then people just go to get the care that they need. The expanded part is expanding it to every person living in the United States from birth to death. And the improved part is that it's more comprehensive. So it includes things that traditional Medicare doesn't include right now, like mental health, dental care, vision, hearing, long-term care. And there are no premiums, no co-pays, and no deductibles. Once people pay in through their progressive taxes, then that's it. They don't get a medical bill. They just, when they need care, they go to the health facility and they get the care that they need. And they can choose where they want to go. They don't get restricted in networks like we do right now with private health insurance.
Donald Trump seems to want to let Obamacare just rot on the vine. Is that politically viable?
Well, you know, Obamacare law has pretty much reached its max, and we're going to see it decline from here on out in terms of, you know, we're not going to see an increase in the number of people who have private health insurance. We're going to see that the out-of-pocket costs and the premiums continue to rise. This is the same trajectory that we've seen at the state level with, you know, similar legislation. And so, yeah, that's just the direction things are going. If Donald Trump does nothing, that's the direction it's going to go. The only other direction to support the ACA is really to throw a lot more money at that, and I don't think that's going to happen.
Now, you've been out campaigning for single payer for all for a very, very long time. In your experience, when Americans are told that this is the only of the industrialized countries in the world that does not have some kind of truly universal health care plan, what's their reaction been?
You know, I think people are starting to really get that. I think that the decades of work by advocates for Medicare for All, educating and organizing in their communities, has really started to get the message out that that's combated what we were told before, that we had the best healthcare system in the world. Nobody can deny that now, that we have great resources, but not the best system, because not all people have access to the care in our country. And, you know, we have so many people going bankrupt every year, people who are dying of preventable causes. So I think that's starting to really resonate with people, especially knowing that both Canada and Mexico, our northern neighbors and southern neighbors, have universal health care systems. And the richest country in the world, there's no reason why we can't have that.
But Hillary Clinton said this will never, ever happen.
Well, you know, we know that all great social change happened because of the work of grassroots activists organizing and demanding it. And so we've always been told throughout time that we can't get the things that we need or that we want, but that has not stopped movements in the past from fighting for it. And that's what we have to recognize now, is it's not up to the politicians. They're never going to give this to us. This is something that we have to organize and be uncompromising and say, this is the only solution that we will accept from our politicians. We have to shift that political culture, and that's how we win.
Well, all right, things are looking good in the House in terms of the Democrats, but what about the Senate?
Well, fortunately, again, due to grassroots pressure, we are going to see Medicare for All legislation in the Senate. Senator Sanders has agreed to introduce legislation similar to H.R. 676 in the House. In the Senate, we expect that to be launched or introduced in mid-May. So that's a good sign, and it means that people need to get active, both pushing their members of Congress in the House and in the Senate. And also, we're hearing an important point that people need to understand is we're also hearing from the Democrats that they can fix the ACA with things like a public option or opening Medicare up to a few more people. And we have to be really clear that those are not solutions that are actually going to fix the problem. They don't address the kind of underlying root causes of our healthcare crisis. And so the smallest step that we should be fighting for right now is a national improved Medicare for All.
And what about efforts in the states, particularly California?
California has introduced legislation. It's not a completely single-payer system, but they were hoping that, you know, they could move it to become that one day. And that has passed out of committee in one body, I think in the Senate there. So, you know, we'll see how that goes. It's very tough to do single-payer, a true single-payer system at the state level. It requires federal legislation, and that's why we are fighting for a national Medicare for All, so that every single person living in the United States has access to high-quality health care.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.